Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are once again joined here on the Mark Steiner Show by Afa Michael Weaver, who grew up here. He's a poet, one of America's great poets, professor in the English department at Simmons University, emeritus, and author of many books. We're talking about Plum Dance, the Plum Flower Dance poems, 1985 to 2005. And Afa, welcome. Good to have you back.
Oh, God, I'm happy to be back.
And it means a lot that that you joined us here doing the fund drive to help out on this fund drive to have your voice add to that power. So I deeply appreciate that as well.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. My pleasure. I can't think of a better thing to do.
So before we talk about your story a little bit, which I want to do, because I think it's important to get this sense of who you are for some folks who may not have read your poetry yet or may not have heard our last program together. Did you get the email I sent just a little bit ago?
I just got it.
Okay.
Just looked over it. And I have some of the poems marked off in the book. And I also have one that I thought might interest you. It's called The Southpaw, about my military experience.
Why don't we start with that?
Okay. This is the winter of 1970 to 71 out in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, during basic training. The Southpaw. The fist is a hand that has made decisions. It has sat on a rock, holding its thoughts over the edge of a lake, weighing this, weighing that. It has paced through woods in autumn, kicking leaves over matters philosophical and literary. It has thought. It has prayed to a God who knows hands and what hands can do in a malleable world. The 16-ounce boxing glove is a fist that never unfurls. Inside it, your hand is forced to conclusions. The glove magnifies the hand and softens it. It makes a fist that is both dangerous and heavy to haul and throw. It protects and threatens. It is like the black flash across space to the face, like a lightning bolt burnt with voltage. In the barracks, we fought for pride. A pound here, a pound there. We battled for the turf of striding out in the sun, smiling. I fought a boy from Kentucky who kept a picture of his Plymouth Roadrunner on his locker. I had nothing against him except he thought he could beat me. He hit me out of Louisville with a left. The eye makes stars when the fist pushes it into the skull socket. A fraction of a second and you are blind, grasping around for focus. I stood away, arched my back, flipped my head to rattle him with glove and grit from a right. He sat and said, "I've had it. No more. Hands can break bodies, bone on bone."
Whoa. That's a powerful remembrance of the Army.
Well, my drill sergeant at the time, I was in cooking school. That was my MOS.
Uh-huh.
And so our drill sergeant was the nephew of the baseball player Stan Musial. So Sergeant Musial was our sergeant, and he'd been to Vietnam several times. He wanted to go back, and they barred him from Vietnam, basically. He was a tough guy, and he liked to see us box in the barracks, and that's what we did.
Because, I mean, you as a kid growing up, I mean, you weren't really a fighter.
Well, I had to be, you know. I played a game called Chess Cave.
Yes, right.
Cousins. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, we fought each other pretty ferociously at times, yeah.
As you used to call in the corner, body punching.
Oh, yes, and try to catch the other person unaware.
Right. So now, one of the things that this describes in some ways is the essence of who you are on one level, which is a working-class poet, a poet who has felt the steel mills and felt his father in the steel mills and felt the working class corners and built his life that way and took a different route to becoming a poet than most people would think.
Yes, I was in the steel mill for a year, which included the time I was in basic training, but also I went to Procter & Gamble there for 14 years, right on the edge of the waterfront there in Locust Point.
Right.
Yeah, I was a warehouseman for the last 10 of those years.
But that you've written and said in other places, and we talked about once before, about how that kind of you find that how that's important to you in terms of what it makes you as a poet.
It is important. I have that sense of work being connected to the body that I think I'll never lose. And, you know, sitting around in an office for 4 or 5 hours a day somehow sometimes seems like cheating, you know? I haven't lifted anything.
You lifted your soul, your mind, your brain, your hand.
Oh, yeah, I did. Lifting the soul over that period of years, you know, coming through my life in the factory and then making a transition into academia. I think lifting the soul is tougher than lifting a 100-pound box for Ivory Soap.
I think it is, too. So would you want to pick another piece out, like maybe from the book or somewhere else you would like to pick? Let's see, I don't know. I'm thinking here, Rambling or maybe PMS?
Okay.
What would you like to do?
I think I'll do PMS.
All right, cool.
Switch tempos here.
Yeah.
PMS. We walk on a path of knives to the stone that is your foundation. It is in a swamp where your fears hang like moss. Snakes slide through tears that have lain there gathering. The rains come every month with thunder that makes your head rattle and break open. It is then that we enter. I hold a light and take your hand in mine. Each step is like both giving up and trying again. Each step opens wounds that bleed and streams of bats squeaking out of us. At the stone, there is an inscription in the hand of a woman now long gone. Off the knives, we take the wooden walkway to see the stone. It turns to fire. The words blazing like faces. I have to pull you closer. Only you understand the words here, under the cry of predatory birds, where the air is humid with blood. The sky flips yellow and then rumbles into black. I tell you our time is nearly gone, and you cry on your knees. At last I do what I am always forced to do. I pick you up and throw you into the water. You explode into a giant flower with purple petals and gold stems. You are you again. The swamp dries to a spring, forest where the stone is a fountain. Our feet forget the knives in your heart.
Now, before we have to take a break to kind of talk about the station, tell us what fueled that poem for you.
My wife at the time, who was a painter and sculptor, she and I would have these intellectual debates about whether PMS was a male construction. And we had the same argument at the same time every month. So I thought I would win by writing the poem.
I love it. I'll try that myself next time.
Well, be careful.
We're talking with Afa Michael Weaver, one of America's great poets, who grew up here in Baltimore. His work, we've been talking about Plumflower Dance Poems, a collection of his poems from 1985 to 2005. We're going to talk when we come back from this break about how Afa got his name Afa, his connection to the Chinese world, his connection to the African world, the marriage of those and what those means to him and his work. Stay with us for that. We've got to come back now and talk about WEAA, and then we'll come back to Afa Michael Weaver. Welcome back. We're back here with Afa Michael Weaver, poet, grew up in Baltimore, one of America's great poets, now a professor emeritus, correct?
Alumni professor.
Alumni professor.
Yeah. Oh,
still teaching. So you're not done yet?
No, not done yet.
So in the few minutes we have left together, Afa, before we get back to another poem, I'd like to talk about your own journey and the journey you made both. Let's talk about both journeys. I think it's important to people hear how, in this brief time we have the other day, how you married these worlds and what they meant to you. It's growing up here in Baltimore City, but then your journey, start with your journey to China and your journey to the name Afa? Let's start with China.
Well, when I was in Baltimore, I was doing Tai Chi. And when I left, I continued it. And I got a Fulbright to teach American Lit in Taiwan in 2002. And that took me into a deeper engagement with the culture. But basically, you know, Chinese culture has given me over the years the space to grow and be a poet, a certain freedom on the inside. At the same time, connecting inside myself in a very deep way. My teacher is still in Baltimore.
So you come back to work with him?
Yes, I do. I see him once a month or so, sometimes once every 2 months, Wang Qinliang.
So, but you also, you're learning to speak Chinese. And so that, again, language is so important to you. And understanding a language like Chinese must also, in some senses, change your perception of just the world.
It does change your perception. There's a cultural space you have to go over. And some people even think, and I think there's a lot to it, that the written language, the Chinese character, creates a different spatial relationship for people who use it. But it is an entirely different world. And as my teacher in Taiwan told me, one of my teachers, she said, English has grammar, we have structure. Not the same thing.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Because I think I interviewed an expert on Chinese language once years and years ago, and an author, and she talked about how you think differently in Chinese than you do in English.
You do think differently, and when you speak and practice speaking Chinese, your brain actually hears you speaking, and there's something physiological that happens when you're using a tonal language, and the meaning in Chinese depends on the tone that you use. And it's a pitch, it's not volume. So a beginner, you know, someone say, ni hao, which is really not, yeah, that's volume, but it's more pitch, it's ni hao,
uh-huh.
So, which is very subtle, but it takes a long time to sort of get those subtleties.
And the appellation Afa, the name you were given.
Afa is an Igbo name. It was given to me by Tesong Weimei. She's a poet and playwright. She lives in Wisconsin.
Wonderful poet and playwright.
Yes, yes. She's something of a living figure in Nigeria. And she gave me the name in 1997. And I took the name to release the spirit of my first son. And I have another son who was born after. He's alive and well.
Good.
Mm-hmm. In Baltimore.
Afa, can we pick something else to read? Do you
mind? Yes. I'd like to read a poem called Sandy Point. And it's for my son, my living son, and my brother, Sandy Point. A flounder follows the line in its mouth over the puzzle frame of black rocks to a silent man. It is a dark fish now on land, this high grass and sand across from the steel mill. My son and my brother are my two sons, only 4 years apart. I am father and brother. Petitioning for authority, for obedience, for adoration. My son throws in his line, pulls out another fish, life from life. He has every gift and does not know my mother's dying wish. Take care of a kala, protect him. I have a bay rod and a reel, always too much. And my brother and son have Zippos, $10 for any fish in the point. Mm-hmm. Here the ghosts of clippers full of Igbo, Hausa, Wolof, Mandinka and more, all these notions of God, ease by on invisible ships. I stop hoping for fish and study humidity rising with abandon, boppers dancing the boogaloo, the rippling egotism of light. My boys take their fish home to my mother. She laughs at how big they are, how small. Later, one morning, my brother will go into another fit of anger, troubling his twin sister, who is his angel. He will threaten to walk out into the street, the moving cars. 5 years to live, my mother tells him, it is a good day to die. Hook, line, in the mouth.
Mm. Whew.
So I bought the boys these Zippo rods for $10. I had a bay rod that I spent twice as much more on, and they were just flipping the fish out of the water one after another. And I hardly caught anything.
When you write a poem like that, and you, it's so, I mean, the sense of where you are, of that moment in time, that you filter through, also just dropping it through in such a lyric way, the lives of African people who were brought to these shores and back again through the souls of your brother and your son. I mean, it's and bringing them home in all their pain and in their smile. I mean, it's amazing that
Oh, thank you. You know, I joined that one of those DNA ancestry projects, and I got back the DNA correspondence chart, and they tell you what cultures your DNA matches, because they take samples all over the world, and 90% of my matches are in Africa. So
really?
Yeah, 90%. You know, there's some sprinkling here and there, Portuguese and even Jewish, but primarily 90% African, and a lot of that Cape Verdean, which was the biggest surprise.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
It was interesting, but I think it's my mother's father. He looks very Cape Verdean. But, yeah, just 90% African DNA. So.
That's good, man. At least you got it.
I suppose so, Mark.
Afa, it is always a joy to talk to you, brother. I thank you so much for helping us out here today as well on this fun drive.
Oh, I wish you all the best in the drive. It's a pleasure talking to you. You have a great laugh. I love to make you laugh.
Thank you, man.
All right.
All right, brother. Take care of yourself.
You too, Mark.
Afa Michael Weaver, an amazing poet. I want you to link to the Steiner Show and to his show with us today and the show he did with us before, just to be able to get to his poems. And I encourage all of you to just read and take his poems in, because they speak to all of us. He's a very powerful writer and a very gentle soul. So we're going to take a brief break and come right back, because we have to talk about something really important in your life, which is this radio station.